Good morning and welcome to the Monday edition of Times the Brief. I'm Harvey Kojan, and these are the top stories of the day. Times the Brief is brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook of your choice at audible.com/thebrief and start listening today. Days of torrential rains kept much of South Carolina and its capital gripped by floodwaters early Monday, as emergency responders promised renewed door-to-door searches for anyone still trapped after a weekend deluge and hundreds of rescues. At least 7 weather-related deaths have been blamed on the vast rainstorm. Heavy rain kept falling into the early hours Monday around the Carolinas from the storm that began swamping the southeast late last week, part of an unprecedented low-pressure system that dumped more than 18 inches on one spot alone in Columbia, the South Carolina capital. The rainstorm dumped so much water on South Carolina and parts of several surrounding states that even the weather experts said they were astonished. "The flooding is unprecedented and historical," said Dr. Marshall Shepard, a meteorologist and director of the Atmospheric Sciences Program at the University of Georgia, in an email to the Associated Press. He said the unique double punch of the upper-level low, aided by a river of tropical moisture in the atmosphere from Hurricane Joaquin spinning far out in the Atlantic, gave the monster rainstorm its punch. The deluge made for otherworldly scenes in the state capital of Columbia, as floodwaters nearly touched the stoplight Sunday at one downtown intersection. Rainwater cascaded like a waterfall over jagged asphalt where a road sheared apart and many cars were submerged under flooded streets. The flooding forced hundreds of weekend rescues and threatened the drinking water supply for hundreds of thousands in Columbia, with officials there warning some could be without potable water for days because of water main breaks. Electrical outages affecting thousands also were reported. Elsewhere, nearly 75 miles of Interstate 95, the main link from the southeast U.S. to the northeast, had to be closed for a time. Officials counted several hundred water rescues at one point Sunday. But Columbia Fire Chief Aubrey Jenkins said in an interview that there were quickly too many rescues to even tally. Among those rescued were a woman and baby lifted to safety by helicopter. Police in Columbia say they and other emergency crews would continue with concentrated search and rescue operations early Monday. Columbia Police Chief William Holbrook issued a statement saying the operations would check for any people in the city and nearby Richland County still needing evacuation from flooded areas. He urged anyone still needing help to call 911, saying they would be taken out on military vehicles and bused to shelters. The operation will also include overall welfare checks, he said, adding crews will mark the front doors of homes checked with a fluorescent orange X once searched. After a nightmarish weekend marked by scenes of swift water rescues, bridge washouts, and small dams giving way, reality was setting in Monday as people waited and hoped for the rains to ease. Some reports indicate the sun could peak out Tuesday. Many recovery tasks lay ahead. Several schools and colleges, including the University of South Carolina, canceled classes Monday, and some businesses planned to stay shuttered. Numerous roads and bridges around the state were washed out or underwater. All will have to be checked to see if they are structurally sound or repaired. "It's going to be weeks or months before all of the roads are assessed," State Adjutant General Bob Livingston Jr. said. People were told to stay off roads and remain indoors until floodwaters recede, and a curfew was in place overnight for Columbia and 2 surrounding counties. The capital city told all 375,000 of its water customers to boil water before drinking because of water line breaks and rising water threatening a treatment plant. Nearly 30,000 customers were without power at one point. One of the hardest-hit areas in Columbia was near Gills Creek, where a weather station recorded more than 18 inches of rain, or more than a third of the city's average yearly rainfall, nearly all of it in 24 hours. The creek was 10 feet above flood stage, spilling floodwaters that almost reached the stoplights at a 4-lane intersection. Rescue crews used boats to evacuate the family of Jeff Whalen, whose house backs up on the creek. "I got up around 6:15 and a neighbor called to tell us we should get out as soon as we can," Whalen said. "About that point, it was about a foot below the door, and when we left, it was a foot in the house. It came quickly, obviously." Along the coast, rainfall had exceeded 2 feet since Friday in some areas around Charleston, though conditions had improved enough that residents and business owners were allowed downtown on a limited basis. Charleston Mayor Joe Riley said he's never seen flooding as bad in his 40 years as mayor. "This was a record storm," he said. At least 7 weather-related deaths have been reported since rains began spreading over the eastern seaboard, which appeared to dodge the full fury of Hurricane Joaquin, which was rapidly weakening as it veered even further out into the Atlantic. 1 death was reported in the Columbia area Sunday. In another incident, a woman was killed when her SUV was swept into floodwaters in Columbia. Richland County Coroner Gary Watts said the woman's body was found Sunday afternoon, about 12 hours after she disappeared in floodwaters near downtown Columbia. 3 people died in separate weather-related traffic accidents in South Carolina on Friday and Saturday, the Highway Patrol said. In North Carolina, a driver died on a rain-slickened road on Saturday, according to that state's Highway Patrol. On Thursday, a woman drowned in her car in Spartanburg, South Carolina, while a passenger in North Carolina was killed when a tree fell onto the highway. The flooding also prompted acts of kindness in Columbia. Rawlings Lamott, 38, a residential real estate broker, said he and a friend got into a small motorboat and ended up ferrying several people to safety, including a man who had been out of town and found roads to his home blocked. "Until you've experienced something like this, you have no idea how bad it really is," Lamott said. Julie Bites, president of the Forest Acres Neighborhood Association, said she paid for a stranger to stay at extended stay after her car was submerged on a nearby flooded road. "You do anything you can to help people," Bites said. This article posted by the Associated Press in Columbia, South Carolina. 3 scientists from Ireland, Japan, and China won the Nobel Prize in Medicine on Monday for discoveries that helped doctors fight malaria and infections caused by roundworm parasites. The Nobel judges in Stockholm awarded the prestigious prize to Irish-born William Campbell, Satoshi Omura of Japan, and Chu Yuyu, the first-ever Chinese medicine laureate. Campbell and Omura were cited for discovering a drug that has helped lower the incidence of river blindness and lymphatic filariasis, 2 diseases caused by parasitic worms. Chu discovered a drug that has helped significantly reduce the mortality rates of malaria patients. The 2 discoveries have provided humankind with powerful new means to combat these debilitating diseases that affect hundreds of millions of people annually, the committee said. The consequences in terms of improved human health and reduced suffering are immeasurable. Campbell is a research fellow emeritus at Drew University in Madison, New Jersey. Omura, 80, is a professor emeritus at Kitasato University in Japan and is from the central prefecture of Yamanashi. Chu is chief professor at the China Academy of Traditional Chinese Medicine. The Medicine Award was the first Nobel Prize to be announced. The winners of the Physics, Chemistry, and Peace Prizes are set to be announced later this week. The Economics Prize will be announced next Monday. No date has been set yet for the Literature Prize, but it is expected to be announced on Thursday. The winners will share about $960,000 in prize money, with 1/2 going to Campbell and Omura and the other to 2. Each winner will also get a diploma and a gold medal at the annual award ceremony on December 10th, the anniversary of the death of prize founder Alfred Nobel. Last year's Medicine Award went to 3 scientists who discovered the brain's inner navigation system. This article posted by the Associated Press in Stockholm. After months of warning investors that its sales and cash were dwindling, American Apparel has filed for bankruptcy protection on Monday, the latest drama befalling a retailer trying to rebound since the ousting last year of its founder and former CEO, Dov Charney. American Apparel in August had reported that sales for its second quarter fell 17.2%, continuing a downward spiral in the last several years that has severely drained its coffers. The clothing manufacturer, famed for its once semi-pornographic ads and emphasis on making its products in Los Angeles, has also been feuding with the controversial Charney, spending millions on litigation to fight the executive, whom American Apparel ousted in December. American Apparel, which said business would continue without interruption during its restructuring, filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy protection in federal court in Wilmington, Delaware. American Apparel's plan calls for restructuring its debt, and creditors will provide $70 million in new capital, as well as a $90 million bankruptcy loan to keep it going. This restructuring will enable American Apparel to become a stronger, more vibrant company. By improving our financial footing, we will be able to refocus our business efforts on the execution of our turnaround strategy, said Paula Schneider, American Apparel's chief executive officer, in a statement. The result of the restructuring will be to reduce American Apparel's debt load by replacing $200 million of its bonds in exchange for equity interests in the reorganized company. The agreement will reduce its $300 million debt to no more than $135 million and annual interest expense by $20 million. Since taking the helm earlier this year, Schneider has been trying to fix American Apparel, announcing a plan in June to get the once iconic retailer's sales up to $1 billion at some point, toning down the company's notoriously raunchy ad campaigns, and streamline its retail footprint to focus on fewer markets but go deeper, rather than have a few stores in countless markets. American Apparel ousted Charney last year after a series of allegations of improper behavior, accusations he has in the past denied. He has since filed several lawsuits against American Apparel, alleging defamation in one. This article, posted by Phil Waba, and originally appeared on Fortune.com.
Utah Representative Jason Chaffetz announced Sunday he is running to replace John Boehner as Speaker, challenging House Majority Leader Kevin McCarthy, who seemed a shoo-in to ascend to the House's highest post until the weekend. "Kevin McCarthy is a good man. He's a big reason why we have such a solid majority. But things have changed, and there's really a math problem," Chaffetz told Fox News Sunday. "You need 218 votes on the floor of the House. There are 246 Republicans who will vote. But there are nearly 50 people and a growing number that will not and cannot vote for Kevin McCarthy as the Speaker on the floor. He's going to fall short of the 218 votes on the floor of the House." As Chaffetz points out, in any vote for Speaker on the House floor, whether they're electing one or deposing one, 218 votes are needed. If a Speaker wants to survive, all 218 better come from the Republican side, which means, with a majority of 246, any would-be Speaker can't lose more than 28 votes or they're kaput. The problem is, the Freedom Caucus, a loosely affiliated group of about 40 Tea Party conservatives, has figured that out. It was the Freedom Caucus's threat to force Boehner to vacate his seat that prompted the Speaker to announce his retirement effective October 30th. And now McCarthy, who says he has the votes sewn up, seems to be facing a similar problem. Further complicating things, Republicans seeking the number 2 and 3 leadership slots are pushing for their votes, scheduled for October 8th, to be pushed back because they want more time to campaign, a move Boehner is considering. In the nation's first 100 years, there were 36 speakers of the House. In the second 100 years, there were just 20. In the last 26 years, there have been 5. But now the tide may be turning. The country could now be entering a new era, the Twitter speakership. McCarthy's speakership seems threatened to be over before it's even begun, mostly because he made the mistake of politicizing the Benghazi committee, thereby giving Hillary Clinton a powerful retort on a subject that was otherwise a loser for her. But even if he does win that thorny crown, odds are that he won't last very long, given a packed legislative schedule filled with bills that are likely to need Democratic votes to pass. Even if he defeats Chaffetz, he could last no more than a month on the job or until the end of the year. In the current House, every bill represents a potential opportunity for the Freedom Caucus to depose the Speaker if they are unhappy with the bill he has put forward, which is likely to be the case at least some of the time. If the Speaker puts forward a bill to continue funding the government, he can be deposed. If he tries to avoid a default on the nation's debt, the same outcome is possible once again. The Ex-Im Bank reauthorization, the Federal Aviation reauthorization, tax extenders vital to the business community, and a multi-year transportation infrastructure bill all must pass items by the end of the year, some, like the debt ceiling, by early November. And yet little or no negotiating for a solution on any of these issues is taking place because of the chaos surrounding the House leadership elections. House Republicans, it would seem, have more than one math problem. The Speaker's lobby, just off the House floor, is adorned with portraits of the 61 speakers to rule the House thus far. The architect of the House might soon consider searching for more wall space. This article posted by J. Newton Small.
Authorities in China and the Philippines said Monday that a typhoon that tore through the northern Philippines before roaring ashore in southern China has killed at least 9 people and left dozens of fishermen missing. The typhoon also prompted several strong tornadoes when it landed in the southern Chinese province of Guangdong on Sunday, killing at least 6 people and injuring 168, local authorities said. In one case, a tornado swept up a car and killed the person inside, the Civil Affairs Department of Guangdong said. The official Chinese news agency said one fisherman also was killed and an additional 16 were reported missing in China. The 22nd typhoon of the year went through the northern Philippines early Saturday, causing floods and a few landslides. It left 2 dead and about 30 fishermen missing, said Regional Office of Civil Defense spokesman Mike Sabato. Nearly 200,000 people in southern China were evacuated before the typhoon made landfall near the city of Zhanjiang in Guangdong Province just after 2 p.m. Sunday, according to the National Meteorological Center. By Monday morning, the typhoon had moved into a neighboring region and its high wind speed dropped to 54 kilometers per hour. The region had ordered 12,700 fishing boats and 35,400 offshore workers to return to port. The typhoon lashed southern China, including a resort island province where thousands of Chinese have flocked during the week-long National Day holiday that runs through Wednesday. Scores of flights in and out of the main airport in the provincial capital have been canceled, and high-speed rail service between the city and the tourist center of Sanya was suspended over the weekend. Meanwhile, more than 500 tourists were sheltering in hotels in Guangdong's Fanji Island after attempts to evacuate them were disrupted by high winds. Nearly 200 fishermen in the Philippines had been reported missing at the height of the storm, but most sailed back home after taking shelter or were rescued at sea. This article posted by the Associated Press in Beijing. Associated Press writer Jim Gomez in Manila contributed to this report. The U.S. Supreme Court term that begins Monday is likely to produce big victories for the court's conservatives, in contrast to last term's liberal-leaning decisions in favor of Obamacare, same-sex marriage, and the right to sue for housing discrimination. The left side did a lot of winning last year, says Professor Irv Gornstein, who directs the Supreme Court Institute at Georgetown University Law Center in Washington, D.C. I would expect a return to the norm in which the right wins most of the big cases. Based on their previous rulings, the court's conservatives seem prepared to deal a blow to public sector unions, further restrict the use of affirmative action in college admissions, and allow religiously affiliated organizations more freedom from the contraceptive insurance coverage requirements under Obamacare. The justices will also soon vote on whether to take up one of the most important abortion cases in 25 years, a challenge to a controversial Texas law that has forced dozens of clinics providing abortion services in the state to close. Passed 2 years ago, it required abortion clinics to meet the same building standards as ambulatory surgical centers, and it directed doctors providing abortions to have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals. This legislation builds on the strong and unwavering commitment we have made to defend life and protect women's health, said Texas Governor Rick Perry in signing the law. Sponsors said it was intended to ensure that women would have the means to get critical emergency care if anything went wrong. Since the law was passed, the number of clinics providing abortion services in Texas has fallen from 42 to 19. If it's upheld, that number could drop to 10. Opponents say the law unconstitutionally burdens the right of access to abortion services. Allowing lower court rulings to stand that upheld the law would cause profound and irreparable harm to the rights, health, and dignity of women, said a representative from the Center for Reproductive Rights. Requirements similar to those in Texas have been passed in 13 other states. In a case that could deal a crippling blow to unions for teachers, police, firefighters, and other public sector employees, the court will decide whether non-union government workers can be required to pay a share of union dues to cover the cost of negotiating contracts. Peter Grebner, a union-affiliated teacher in St. Paul, Minnesota, said the case could upend the ability of millions of working people like me in dozens of states across the country to join together to provide a better education for our kids and fight for better wages and benefits that we can sustain our families on. A group of non-union teachers in California claims that being forced to pay even a share of union dues violates their free speech rights, forcing them to subsidize the activities of a union whether they agree with its goals or not. In this era of broken municipal budgets and a national crisis in public education, it is difficult to imagine more politically charged issues than how much money cash-strapped local governments should devote to public employees or what policies public schools should adopt to best educate children, said Michael Carvin, a lawyer for the Challengers. But California compels non-union members to fund a very specific point of view on these pressing public questions. Since 1997, the Supreme Court has held that requiring non-union members to pay the cost of collective bargaining prevents free riders, meaning workers who get the benefits of a union contract without paying for it. But in subsequent rulings, several of the court's conservatives have suggested that the decision should be overruled. I would not feel very good about my prospects if I were the unions, said Aaron Murphy, a Washington, D.C. lawyer who specializes in federal appeals court cases. The issue of affirmative action in college admissions is back. The justices will again hear a challenge to the program at the University of Texas at Austin. The school says students learn better when there's diversity on campus and within racial groups, but opponents say that's too vague a standard to justify making distinctions based on race. The Supreme Court gave a limited victory to the University of Texas 2 years ago, but instructed a federal appeals court to review whether the program passed constitutional muster. After the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in favor of Texas, opponents again appealed, and now the Supreme Court will once more hear their challenge, a fact that has advocates of affirmative action worried. I don't see a win for Texas, said Gornstein, who notes that Justice Anthony Kennedy may have the deciding vote. Kennedy believes in integration but wants it by race-neutral means, Gornstein said. And the court is likely to take up another challenge to the contraceptive insurance coverage requirements of Obamacare. Religiously affiliated groups, including the Little Sisters of the Poor, say taking any steps in the process, even to opt out of the requirement, violates their religious freedom. They want the same kind of total exemption given to churches. During his U.S. visit, Pope Francis made a point of meeting with the Little Sisters. The Vatican spokesman, the Reverend Federico Lombardi, said it was intended to be a sign of support for them. The outcome of another Texas case could change the makeup of legislatures in states with large immigrant populations. Two state residents urged the court to rule that in drawing legislative boundaries to create districts with roughly equal populations, states must count the voting population, not the total population. The challengers say using the total population figures dilutes the voting power of residents in districts with large numbers of people who are not eligible to vote, violating the one-man, one-vote requirement. Almost all states use total population figures. Relying instead on voting population could result in fewer districts in areas that tend to elect Hispanic representatives. As for the makeup of the Supreme Court, this term is not likely to bring any changes. Its 9 members all seem healthy, and there's a long history of the justices avoiding retirements during a presidential campaign. This article posted by Pete Williams for NBC News. Times the Brief is brought to you by Audible. Audible is the world's leading provider of spoken audio entertainment. From current events to lectures, from histories to mysteries, Audible has the spoken word content you need to keep informed while your hands are busy, but your mind is free. Audible is now offering a free audiobook of your choice and a free 30-day trial. Just go to audible.com/thebrief, download a title free, and start listening. Reclaim your commute and discover something new. Get your free audiobook today by signing up at audible.com/thebrief.
In a studio full of professional ballet dancers, it's harder than you might think to spot the ones who are principals, the highest rank in a company. But there's something different about Yuriko Kajiya, tucked in the corner of the Houston Ballet's company class. When she lifts her leg into an arabesque, she holds it there longer than her neighbors. She, not gravity, seems to decide when it's time to come down. When she turns on the tops of her point shoes, she sails around the corner with control. She has that ability to take your breath away at times on stage, says artistic director Stanton Welch, who's teaching today's class. That's what you're looking for as a choreographer and a director, somebody who has that unexplainable thing. For Kajiya, 31, that magic was hard-earned. As a 10-year-old girl, she moved from her hometown of Nagoya, Japan, to China in 1994 to attend the Shanghai Dance School, a government-run institution where students were hand-picked from countless applicants for their perfect ballet bodies, the long legs and high arches, which was a problem for Kajiya. "I didn't have any of that," she says. Kajiya was the only foreigner in her class, and the teachers mostly ignored her. The treatment, too, was harsh. "In China, they weigh you after a weekend," she says, "and the teachers often beat their students with a stick. Trying to fit in, my identity was lost," she says. "I wanted to be Chinese so badly, just because I wanted everyone to treat me the same." But Kajiya's position as an outsider only motivated her to work harder. "When the instructors began to teach solo variations, that's when I started getting addicted to practicing," she says. "I was a real bunhead." Kajiya would arrive an hour early to class and leave the studio only when they shut off the lights. The teacher would say, "You know who's the worst one in class? It's Yuriko, but she works the hardest." Ballet is an art of delayed rewards, and Kajiya's started flowing in at age 15 when she competed in the International Prix de Lausanne in Switzerland. Even though she was the youngest age eligible for the competition, she won and was awarded a year-long scholarship to Canada's National Ballet School. By age 17, Kajiya could go practically anywhere she wanted, and she chose the American Ballet Theatre in New York City, one of the country's most prestigious companies. For the first 10 of her 12 years with the main company, she was the only Japanese dancer. "As a student in Japan, I idolized all the Japanese dancers who went abroad to go to different companies," she says. "I realized I had become one of them. I had all these little ballerina girls come up to me and say how they wanted to be like me." Now, Kajiya frequently performs in Japan and makes a point to interact with her young fans. "I want to offer what I have to the Japanese dialogue, what I have learned from America," she says. Even though Kajiya is one of the most recognized dancers in Japan, she still writes back to every email and fan letter. "It's very important to me," she says. Kajiya gained inspiration from the ballet idols she wrote to as a child. "It gave me so much hope and joy. I want to do the same thing, and that's what I can offer." Most of her letters come from young Japanese ballerinas who ask Kajiya everything from why they can't pirouette properly to why their parents won't let them do ballet. "She'll respond, and sometimes we'll meet these people at a gig," says Jared Matthews, a fellow dancer who met Kajiya at the American Ballet Theatre and who is now her fiancé. "They'll say, 2 years ago I wrote, and you wrote back to me. It changed my life." In 2014, Kajiya and Matthews left the American Ballet Theatre to join the Houston Ballet, where they are now both principal dancers. She has a whole audience of new young ballerinas to inspire. "The way dancers really lead, I think, is through their work ethic," says Welch, and Kajiya's determination to succeed against the odds is especially motivating. "When you can see someone working and performing and being smart and growing, that is what is inspirational to young dancers." As the studio clears out from the morning class, Kajiya slips on a practice tutu and turns to smile at her partner waiting across the studio. Matthews and Kajiya are practicing the wedding scene from Don Quixote before they leave in a few hours for a performance tour of Japan. As the music starts, they turn away from the mirror to dance to the window, the vast open Houston sky, their imaginary audience. The real one, full of lots of star-struck ballerina girls, will come tomorrow. This article posted by Mandy Oaklander in Houston.
Standing in front of a classroom full of exuberant 17 and 18-year-olds in a high school just outside Gothenburg, Sophia Appelgren has no trouble getting the kids' attention. Though the flame-haired 33-year-old Swedish entrepreneur doesn't appear to have much in common with the students, all immigrants and refugees who mostly hail from the Middle East and Africa, they nod knowingly as she describes a recent trip to Turkey. When Appelgren explains that her Turkish in-laws love to embrace her and pinch her cheeks, gestures that are less than common in reserved Sweden, the students laugh and burst into applause. They know exactly what she means. Many of their own families are very similar. As the founder of MittLive, a social enterprise that aims to place educated immigrants into jobs in Sweden, Appelgren has spent years bridging cultural divides. MittLive, Swedish for My Life, was launched in 2008 when Appelgren decided she wanted to help newcomers integrate into Swedish society. Her long-term partner and the father of her children is Turkish-Swedish, so she had seen how difficult it can be for those with foreign backgrounds in her home country. "I wanted to create a platform where people from all over the world can meet and feel included in society and the labor market," she says. "It's no small task. Sweden has a generous immigration policy and last year received the most asylum applications per capita in the EU. Yet getting into the country is just the first step to a new life. As Appelgren says, Sweden is a place with two doors. The first is the door to the country. This door is open. The second is the door to the labor market, and it's closed." So Appelgren began pairing smart, driven young immigrant women with mentors who could offer advice on everything from resumes to job interviews to Swedish cultural customs. No cheek pinching for a start. MittLive is not a charity. Some of Sweden's top corporations pay the company to not only take on mentees but also to consult on how to diversify their workforce. That business model has helped the organization grow. MittLive started with just 40 people in its mentorship program. Now some 400 people are mentored between September and June every year. David Liga, the deputy mayor of Gothenburg and a longtime mentor to Appelgren, says it's her habit of looking for solutions rather than focusing on problems that's allowed MittLive to flourish. "She focuses on what people can do instead of always getting stuck," he says. "What's more," he says, "she believes what she's talking about." Appelgren has plans to expand further and hopes to set up MittLive in more regions. But she hopes that eventually an organization like hers won't be necessary at all in Sweden and that integration won't be a challenge for those arriving. "Either you're in the world or you're creating your own little world," she says. And in Appelgren's world, there's no reason why everyone can't work together. This article posted by Megan Gibson in Gothenburg. The Islamic State of Iraq and Greater Syria has destroyed the UNESCO World Heritage-listed Ark of Triumph in the ancient Syrian city of Palmyra, the country's head of antiquity said Monday. According to AFP, the Syrian director of antiquities said the ark was leveled Sunday and had been booby-trapped for weeks. He also stated that other monuments in the area have been rigged for similar demolition. This is a systematic destruction of the city. They want to raze it completely, he told AFP. ISIS deems the cultures and monuments of the pre-Islamic societies of the region to be idolatrous. Since capturing the city in May, ISIS militants have destroyed a shrine and a temple. The temple was 2,000 years old and regarded as the greatest gem of Palmyra's antiquities. Experts say that, in addition to destroying ancient sites, ISIS has been selling artifacts on the black market in attempts to ramp up funding for their organization. Before the war in Syria, around 150,000 tourists visited Palmyra, known as the Pearl of the Desert, every year. This article posted by the Times staff. Is beauty really in the eye of the beholder? A new study says yes, discovering that 50% of people's preferences for faces is unique to them, and who we find attractive is most strongly influenced by our life experiences. If you were to rate faces for attractiveness and I were to rate the same faces, we would agree about 50% of the time, says study author Jeremy Wilmer, an assistant professor of psychology at Wellesley College, whose new research was published Thursday in the journal Current Biology. The two-part study first had around 35,000 people rate faces for attractiveness on the website testmybrain.org. Prior research has suggested that people generally agree that symmetrical faces are better looking. That and other factors may account for the 50% consensus on beauty. As for the other 50% of faces, that's where the science really gets interesting. In the second part of the study, the researchers studied the facial preferences of 547 pairs of identical twins and 214 pairs of fraternal twins. The hope was that by studying people who are genetically the same, or at least very similar, and who grew up in the same environment, they would gain some insight into the nature or nurture effects of where the eye of the beholder variation in attractiveness perception comes from. If something is really influenced by genes, you would expect identical twins to be more similar to each other than the fraternal twins, Wilmer says. On the other hand, if family environment is highly influential, the researchers would expect fraternal twins to be quite similar to each other in preferences. But that's not what they found. In our case, we found that even though identical twins share all of their genes and their family environment, they were really, really different from each other in their facial aesthetic preferences, says Wilmer. It's likely personal experiences inform who we find attractive, and because they are so personal, we can greatly differ from someone who, on paper, is quite similar to us, the research suggests. So, what types of experiences influence who we find attractive? The researchers didn't study this in their paper, but study author Laura Germain of Massachusetts General Hospital says that based on previous literature on this subject, they have some theories. Prior research has found things like if you take a face and you pair it with positive information, that face then looks more attractive, and faces that are similar to it also look more attractive, and vice versa, she says. So you can imagine as you go through life and you form relationships and have friends and people you have a more positive relationship with, you may come to find their face characteristics more attractive, and then other people who look similar to them are then more attractive to you. Exposure to certain faces makes them seem more attractive, she adds. That means a face that is very different from a face that you have never seen before tends to be judged as less attractive. It also means the kinds of faces you are exposed to in your work environment, in your relationships, or even the face of your spouse could shift the kind of faces that you find attractive, she says. Basically, who you find attractive may be less about where you grew up and where you went to school and more influenced by experiences that are very unique to you. More research is still needed, but the study suggests that beauty really may be in the eye of the beholder. This article posted by Alexandra Sifferlin. Portugal's center-right coalition government earned another four-year term Sunday, winning a general election behind an improving economy that weathered the austerity measures contested across Europe but falling short of a crucial outright majority in parliament. with 99% of districts reporting. The government had 37% compared with 32% for the main opposition center-left Socialist Party. Smaller leftist parties made up the rest. The victory was bittersweet, however, as the government failed to achieve a parliamentary majority. That means it will be outnumbered in the 230-seat chamber by left-of-center lawmakers who could block its policy proposals. A period of political instability could ensue, making investors once again nervous about the Eurozone's ability to sort out its economic problems. Incumbent Prime Minister Pedro Passos Coelho said his government is determined to abide by the Eurozone's fiscal rules. He said he is willing to compromise with opposition parties to achieve the essential goal of reducing national debt. Times haven't been easy, and the times ahead will be challenging, he said. Portugal needed a 78 billion euro bailout in 2011 amid the Eurozone's debt crisis. The government complied with a German-led austerity plan to restore the 19-nation bloc's financial health, cutting pay, pensions, and public services, and increased taxes that brought large street protests and strikes. The austerity policies helped propel Portugal into a 3-year recession, and the socialists were optimistic they would benefit from a backlash against the government. Socialist leader António Costa conceded defeat, but warned that the government must change its conduct now that it has lost its outright majority in parliament. The government has to understand that things are different now, Costa said, adding that he would not seek to make the country ungovernable. The economy is improving, allowing the government to argue that austerity is paying off. The economy grew 1.5% in the first half of this year compared with the same period in 2014. The unemployment rate has fallen from a record 17.7% in 2013 to 12.3% last July. Portugal shunned the kind of radical alternatives that have emerged in Europe in recent years, such as Greece's Syriza and Spain's Podemos, which have challenged mainstream parties from the far left. The Portuguese have a traditional preference for moderate parties, and voters apparently feared knocking the long-awaited economic recovery off track. A handful of grassroots anti-austerity parties barely registered in the ballot. The Portuguese government's showing will give heart to Mariano Rajoy's conservative government in neighboring Spain, which faces an election December 20th. Rajoy's government has imposed deep spending cuts, but growth has returned to the country. Passos Coelho, Portugal's 51-year-old prime minister, has nurtured an image as a cool-headed, resolute leader who is determined to restore his country's fortunes through unpopular measures and painful reforms, whatever the political cost. He says Portugal can't afford to go back to the borrow-and-spend policies and must live within its means. The government, made up of the Social Democratic Party and its junior partner, the Popular Party, united the right-of-center vote, while the left-of-center vote was fragmented between the Socialists, the Left Bloc, with at least 10%, its best-ever result, and the Communist Party, with 8%. The election outcome wasn't so much a victory for the government as a defeat for the Socialists, said António Barroso, a London-based analyst with the Tineo Intelligence Political Risk Consulting Group. The Socialist Party promised to start easing the tax burden and speed up growth through domestic consumption, but the Socialists had a credibility problem because they led Portugal to the brink of bankruptcy 4 years ago. Teresa Godinho, a middle-aged psychologist voting at a polling station in Lisbon suburbs, said she didn't entirely agree with the government, but voted for it because there were no other viable options. "I lost my trust in the Socialist Party when they left us nearly bankrupt," she said. But Tiago Amaral, a salesman unemployed for the past 18 months, said he opted for the Socialists because he was frustrated. "All I know is something's got to change," he said. This article posted by Barry Hatton for the Associated Press in Lisbon, Portugal.
Fewer than 10% of the world's population will live in extreme poverty for the first time by the end of 2015, according to the World Bank, moving one step closer to the body's stated goal of global extreme poverty eradication by 2030. Using a new poverty line, the World Bank estimates that the global population living in poverty will fall to 702 million people in 2015, which is approximately 9.6 of the population, which is approximately 9.6% of the population. In 2012, 12.8%, or around 902 million people, lived in extreme poverty globally. The International Financial Institution updated its global poverty line from $1.25 to $1.90 to reflect inflation and changes in purchasing power around the world. This is the best story in the world today. These projections show us that we are the first generation in human history that can end extreme poverty, Jim Yong Kim, the president of the World Bank, said in a statement. Yong credited investments into education and social safety nets for the dramatic reduction in poverty around the world. However, he acknowledged that certain difficult hurdles need to be overcome before this ambitious goal is reached. He warned that poverty is becoming more deeply entrenched in conflict zones and countries dependent on commodity exports. He also said that poverty remains a pressing issue in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia, although rates are expected to decline in both regions. This article posted by Joanna Plasinska.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Harvey Kojan, and you've been listening to the daily edition of Times the Brief. To get this sent to your inbox every morning, go to time.com/thebrief. You can also subscribe through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. I'll be back tomorrow. Until then, enjoy the day.